Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever they download it, put it on your iPod, iPad, whatever device you want, and listen to it. Today we have a real interesting show, as we have two of the thought leaders in e-discovery who are going to talk about the production of ESI in e-discovery matters. I'm ashamed to say, now over 100 shows in the ESI Bytes, I was sort of surprised to see that we hadn't covered this topic yet, and it does represent an entire step in the EDRM process, so it's well overdue that we covered this. Items I hope to cover in the show are what the different production options are, cost considerations, how it should be handled, common mistakes, where things get ugly, good outcomes, where the market seems to be heading. What's also interesting about the show is both Tim Opsitnik and Craig Ball, who are on the show, come at this from different directions. So we might have an entertaining show here. They've also both been special masters in a number of high-profile cases. So both panels are used to providing guidance to parties who might not agree on a solution. So should be an informative show. Briefly, Craig Ball is the first panelist of Austin, Texas, is a board-certified trial lawyer, certified computer forensic examiner, and electronic evidence expert, and really needs very little introduction. He's dedicated his career to teaching the bench and bar about forensic technology and trial tactics. Craig writes the award-winning Ball in Your Court column on electronic discovery for Law Technology News and is the author of numerous articles on e-discovery and computer forensics, which can be found at www.craigball.com. And Craig's been a frequent guest on ESI Bytes. The second panelist, Tim Opsitnik, is senior partner and general counsel at Juranov, which is a legal technology company. Tim's been an active participant with the Sedona Conference working group series on best practices for electronic document retention and production. He's contributed to a number of their publications. He's been a contributor on information security for lawyers and law firms, which has been published by a section of the ABA. He's also a member of the Georgetown University Law Center for Continuing Legal Education and advisory board, where he's helped to develop their programs. Tim has been a longtime supporter of ESI Bytes, which he actually hosts, so we always appreciate Tim. With that in mind, first of all, I'd like to jump into the show here. And Tim, if you'd like to start out by describing what the options are for producing ESI, which are outlined in the federal rules, and if there's a right answer. Maybe you can end the podcast now by telling us what it is.
Well, I wish there were one right answer. That's definitely not the case. Litigants have many options and, frankly, have varied needs. Under Rule 34B, the requesting party may specify the form or forms that ESI is to be produced. Once that's been done, the responding party may object to the form specified by the requesting party and state the reason for the objection and indicate the form or forms that the responding party chooses to produce the data in. If in fact no form of production is specified, then the producing party must state the form or forms that the ESI will be produced. A producing party must produce ESI in the form or forms in which it is ordinarily maintained or another reasonably usable format. And another reasonably usable format is an important context here. One thing that's clear from the committee notes is that a producing party is not permitted to produce the ESI in a form that makes it more difficult or burdensome for the requesting party. For example, if you indicate that you're going to produce it in a fixed image format, such as PDF or TIFF, when you need to include the content and relevant metadata so that it is searchable and can be otherwise organized. The touchstone for what is necessary is what is necessary from an evidentiary perspective, in my mind. The purpose, I think, of this dance is to get the parties to discuss the issue and resolve it, or to get it in front of the court for a resolution. Unfortunately, like many things dealing with ESI, there's no perfect case, and they all have different circumstances, unique types of data, require different solutions, and compromise between the parties. As evidenced in when they revised the Rule 34B to include form or forms, because the committee recognized that you simply can't have one form probably for productions in many and most cases. And, you know, it's just that the different data types do not support that sort of simplicity.
I'm sure we'll get into that in a few questions down the line. Now, Craig, do you have any preferences when you're considering form of production?
I do, Carl, but those preferences hinge on the form that the data takes natively, the form in which it exists, balanced against the way the data will be used post-production. As Tim just touched on, several years ago when I testified before the committee drafting the Federal e-Discovery Amendments, one of the things that brought me to Washington was to urge them to eliminate their plan to have a reference to a single form of production and incorporate the or forms language in recognition of the fact that Tim just referenced that there really is no universal form of production for all forms of ESI. There's no magic form that ensures efficiency, accessibility, searchability, and functionality in the information produced. I'm very pleased that they elected to make that change. Now, arguably, there is a best form of production, and I think Tim alluded to this, and that is the form or forms on which the parties can agree. That may not be the least costly form. It may not be the most efficient or utile form, but it's certainly the least contentious, and sometimes that's enough. In time, I think, Carl, parties and counsel will ultimately conclude that the forms that maintain the highest level of functionality and informational integrity are preferable, and that the forms that demand the least processing are the most efficient and cost-effective. And that's going to be what matters here. What works, what's affordable, if we're going to be able to keep this engine of justice running. When that recognition finally takes hold, and I would have hoped it would have been by now, but I keep hoping, we'll all know that staying closest to the native format will be the rule, and in my opinion, tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars that are now wasted on imaging conversions will be saved.
So, Tim, mechanically, we mentioned there are different options. How do some of these different options play out for production, that are the different options?
Well, there are, as Craig's indicated, there are many, many different formats. So I'm just going to talk mechanically about the most prevalent ones. And Craig, if you'd like, you'd be happy to talk about two of the, you know, some of the more unique formats. But, you know, the most prevalent one that people talk about is the native format. And, you know, we typically recommend that a party maintain ESI in as close to the native format as possible throughout the entire production. And ultimately, you may well choose to produce it in some other format, which is, you know, otherwise, you know, a usable, reasonably usable format. And we're going to talk about that some later. But I typically let the type of matter and the size and type of data at issue make the decisions for me. But let me talk about a couple specific examples. And the first is the native format. But we're going to talk a little bit later about, you know, that's even more complex than we like to think because, you know, what is the native format? That in and of itself is and can be problematic agreeing on that issue, especially, for example, email. You know, in its true native format, it's in the actual container or database file where it's maintained typically and not in an individual email as typically produced or maintained on many databases. The second format that, you know, mechanically that people talk about, and Craig has, you know, mentioned involving processing and creating something into a fixed image format. And when you use that format, what you typically do is you extract the metadata, and that may include the content, the written information within the ESI, and you extract that metadata, the content, document properties, and other things. And you take the document itself and you create it into a PDF or a TIFF when we talk about it being in a fixed image format because it's like a locked picture, a picture of the document, if you will. So those are the two most common formats that we see in mechanically. You know, they differ because there's some level of processing necessary to get something into the fixed image format.
Craig, when should a form of production and a proposed strategy first be raised? And what should you do if you can't get an agreement there?
Carl, do you mind if I add something to what Tim just discussed before we move into that question?
Absolutely.
He should,
Tim offered.
Yeah, because I definitely offered. I wanted him to comment on that.
Give us something exotic.
I think we're still working to master the common before we move into the exotic. The exotic's easy because when you get to the exotic, you start bringing people together who understand the information. And it's been my experience that when people who understand electronic data get together, they don't have much trouble coming to agreement. It's only when we're working through intermediaries that it becomes a problem. Tim made very clear that his company's advice is keep it native as long into the process as possible. Now, that's the best advice that you could get because the longer you can keep it unchanged, the longer you can work with it and it's in the way it lays, the lower your costs and the richer the informational payload that is in that information. Now, when we go to these image formats, the notion is, oh, well, we put Humpty Dumpty back together again. I mean, sure, we lose the source, but we take a picture of it, and then we create another file that holds the text as best we can pull it out, and then we hold another file that sort of tells you how to assemble it, like getting one of those models that you put together as a kid, and you glue it all back together. And we extract the metadata. Well, Tim, of course, was simplifying it for discussion purposes. He knows how complex that statement is. There's a lot of metadata out there. It's not just the properties of a file. You may be dealing with information that has embedded commentary and embedded track changes. You have embedded dates that are different from system dates. You have information living in a very rich three-dimensional environment, a SharePoint environment or a web environment. It's information that may be on a structured social networking site like Facebook. So it's not that there's this, the metadata, give me the metadata, and that makes sense to anybody who really understands ESI. You can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again very well. You're always going to lose some level of functionality, some component of informational integrity. And we have to understand that trade-off. It's going to be made. There are going to be trade-offs. But right now, I don't think people appreciate what they're losing. Now, I'm ready for that next question.
All right, I'll repeat it. So, Craig, when should form of production and a proposed strategy first be raised, and then what do you do if you can't get an agreement?
Well, it's never too soon. If you don't consider the destination when you depart, it's a sure bet that you're going to waste time and money on the journey. It's essential that forms be specified in the discovery request. I mean, that's the latest time when you should have made decisions about if you have this, I want it like this. And it shouldn't be this notion that I've got to come up with the right answer. Give it to me in native. Give it to me in near native. Give it to me in TIFF. There are different forms that make economic sense and functional sense for different forms of information. For some kinds of information, you want to give me a TIFF and a load file, I can live with it because there's relatively little difference between the source and the outcome. For other forms, it's absolutely essential that I get either the native or a near-native format. Now, I don't expect that if you have your email in an Exchange database that you're going to give me the native Exchange database. I can dream, but I'm not expecting it. So I'm going to get a near-native format, something that is compatible with the source, that carries most, if not all, of the information associated with the parts of the source that are discoverable and relevant, and we'll move forward from there. But you should be talking about form of production in the same circumstances where you would discuss preservation. Many of the cases that have denied production of native and near-native forms were based on what I call the one-byte rationale. That is, if you ask for a different form of production, even a much better or more rational form of production, after you've already gotten it in some format, the courts have been inclined to say, no, you're too late, or to shift costs for reproducing in the form that probably should have been produced in the first instance. So even more with most endeavors, I think the adage, well begun is half done, resonates with e-discovery. You can't start too early to think about what it is you want to get and the form in which you want to get it.
And you know, Craig, you keep mentioning native and near native. What's the difference between native and near native? I mean, what types of things are you stripping out to get to near native? Is that like a bikini versus naked or something? Or
now I have entirely different mental pictures for that, Carl. Well, I think the example that I gave a moment ago is probably a good one, and that is that most people's email doesn't live in as an individual single message format. It lives in a container file. On a server, it might be the so-called Exchange database or the NSF file of a Lotus Notes environment, Domino environment. Now, I'm getting a little into the weeds, so let me back up. On your computer, if you use Outlook, most of your email, your calendar, your contacts, they're all going to be in a container file called a PST or an OST. Well, you're not generally going to just turn over the whole container any more than you would turn over the entirety of a file cabinet. You're going to make selections, and you're going to make redactions. You're going to make exclusions based on privilege. So we have to open that container and deal with its component parts. Those component parts are the near native formats. For email, it might be a .msg format. It might be a .eml format accompanied by a file that will indicate where those particular message items had been located within the construct of the user's email foldering. So you have a mix of load file that accompanies even native forms that gives you what information the near native may have left behind in the container.
Okay, thanks. Tim, are there any cost considerations when you're looking at a production options between TIFFs and PDFs and natives?
Sure, but I don't think they're as relevant as they once were. What do I mean by that? Again, I mean, technology is sort of solving a lot of these problems for us. Most of the tools today allow you to host and review the data in its near-native format as close to as possible, and then make decisions about production somewhere down the road, the format that the production takes. In the old days, I think there was a great deal of upfront cost in immediately processing to fixed image format everything that you had, because that's the way a lot of the tools worked, and because of the ease of reviewing the documents and the data and the viewers required and things like that. Everything was converted to a fixed image format. We've evolved beyond that. I think there are certainly law firms and others with legacy systems out there, but I don't think that we should be forced to necessarily be pulled back to the lowest common denominator. And I think that a lot of these tools have moved on in such that you need to let the nature of the case and the size and type of the data that is being reviewed and the tools being utilized to dictate the reasonableness of the formats for the production.
Craig, what are common mistakes that you see made at the production stage? I know we talked about one, not getting an agreement with the other side and what you're going to do, do you see other types of issues?
Yes. Well, the big number one, even before failing to get the agreement, is failing to specify the form or forms at the outset. I'm frustrated at how many requesting parties still have some kind of mealy-mouthed language in their general definition of document that just says, give it to me in native. And then we've just identified how a very big chunk of certain information can't be given in its true native. So what you want to do is you want to think about, if it's this, I want it like that. If it's a spreadsheet in Excel, well, give me the XLS or XLSX native file. I want that. If it's a Word document, maybe I want doc, or maybe I want PDF. If it's a database, you're probably not going to say, I want the entire database. You're going to think sensibly about the kinds of information that they have and your capabilities internally to work with it. Be careful what you wish for with certain forms, because you may get it and you may find yourself incapable of working with it or requiring the need for an enormous amount of assistance or purchase of software and hardware that wasn't in your budget. The next after failing to agree is failing to advise about alternate forms of production. I mean, you heard Tim say in reading the rule, the producing party must state the form in which ESI will be produced. And this is such a huge mistake because the goal was, I tell you as requesting party the form in which I want it. You either say okay or you object. But if you object, you got to tell me no, I'm giving it to you like thus. And you have to do this early enough before you actually produce it that affords the requesting party a reasonable opportunity to go to the court and say, Your Honor, they're going to give it to me in a way that I can't use it or that leaves information behind. And this dance, this choreography that is essential to this working is unilaterally ignored by one side or the other or both. Requesting party either fails to specify properly or the producing party just says, yeah, right, and the horse you rode in on, I'm giving you TIFF and a load file, take it or leave it, but you don't find it out until the disks of the hard drive arrive, and by then it may be too late.
Tim, what sorts of problems can you get into with native productions?
Well, Craig has already started to talk about one of my favorite English poet's statements that I used very often when I was practicing as an attorney in litigation, and that is that, and now I've forgotten it, there are two great tragedies in life, not getting what you ask for and getting what you ask for. And with that, I'll say that native productions are not necessarily as clear-cut and straightforward as we'd like them to be. They, in fact, may place needless and unreasonable burdens on the producing party and may well disadvantage both litigants. They're not without problems. First, we've already talked about, you know, what exactly do you mean by native? We can get in discussions, we can get in debates, we can get into conflict about what is near native, you know, what is the format. I think reasonable minds can come to agreement on a lot of these issues. Nonetheless, they often present themselves as red herrings. Second, the native file may be unreadable, unusable, or in fact, not readily accessible as defined under 26B2 in its native form because of some sort of a legacy software system or legacy software that's being used to review the native file.
I agree with you, Tim, but what I see that manifesting itself as is a very paternalistic, condescending attitude of, you can't possibly deal with data in the sophisticated ways we deal with it, so therefore we're dumbing it down to...
Well,
image for you.
And again, I think you've got to come to an agreement. That's why somebody can't say, I want it all in native. The people have to be reasonable. I can't give it to you in native. Finally, I'm done fighting with you. Here, take it in native. You won't be able to do anything with it. But so, you know, you need to have some relevant transparency, and you need to talk about these issues, and you need to resolve them regarding it. And third, as acknowledged in the committee notes, the size, scope, and complexity of the case may make production in native formats disadvantaged to the litigants because of the inability to track such documents and depositions via Bates labels, or another example is the inability to redact documents in their native format to protect trade secret or confidential information. Now look, technology is evolving, and these situations are getting better and better every day. But they still present problems in certain mass tort litigation involving multiple parties and different states and different counsel. Having documents in a fixed image format with a Bates number on them so that we know what's being presented in a deposition, that it's a bona fide document, those are important things. Fourth, producing documents in a different form other than native may be helpful in that it poses limits on the inadvertent or, in fact, the regrettable purposeful modification of a native file.
So, Craig, I know that you've come out strongly in the beginning about some of the issues with TIFFs and PDFs. Do you want to add to that? Because that wasn't the initial question in there, but I know you've got strong feelings. So, what issues do you see?
Well, I do, and I think, you know, Tim used the right term, which is red herrings. The emphasis on very costly and inefficient uses of imaging and load files generating a lot of processing either on a per gigabyte or more likely on a per page basis. Enormously profitable for many. It's enormously profitable for the vendor community to convert. It is enormously profitable to do mass conversions for purposes of review because in the image format, you really are limited in some of the tools that you can use. But let me back off of that for just a minute and talk about something a great deal more practical, and that is Bates numbering, embossing with limitations and origins information, untoward change, and redaction. Those are the big arguments that are always offered in favor of why you can't do native production. And let's deal with those. Well, first, sure, there are times when you want to have a Bates number or a label of some type on a document. And those times are when you're using it in deposition or you're introducing it for use at trial. But that is a tiny, tiny microcosm for any good lawyer of the overall volume of information produced. Any veteran trial lawyer is going to say to you, if you're using hundreds of documents or hundreds of key exhibits at trial, you're confusing the jury. You want to keep it simple. So you can always go to embossing onto paper or onto images when you're going to use the information. And when you do that, you go ahead and image it or you print it, you emboss your control numbers, your Bates numbers, et cetera, and you provide a copy of that limited set that's being used to the other parties. It's just that simple. Mm. But you do not convert everything to images just so you can have the comfort of that very early in the process. Another problem you have is this issue of redaction. Do I agree that images should be used for redaction? Sure. There are issues in many instances with trying to achieve true native redaction. It's feasible in certain kinds of forms. It's actually quite feasible in many types of productivity documents like Word documents and spreadsheets that make up a large volume of information. It can be done, but it's a proportionality issue. It's a reasonableness issue. The amount of volume of information being redacted for privilege in most cases is a tiny fraction of the volume of overall production. If you want to image and redact by obliteration that component, have a party. Go to it. That probably makes sense. But don't let that hair on the tail wag the dog. And that's my problem with the redaction issue. Sure, okay, image for redaction. Then you get the issue of inadvertent change. It's much easier to detect a change, alteration, inadvertent or intentional, in an electronic document than it is on a printed counterpart, because you can use tools that are mechanical to determine absolutely if there's been an alteration, whereas you must bring a magnifying glass and human judgment to alterations that have been made to a document. I would much rather evaluate a complex spreadsheet by hashing it to know that it hasn't changed than by trying to compare column by column and number by number to see that someone didn't inadvertently allow a calculation change because a new date was plugged in by accident.
Okay. Tim, we've talked a lot about different fields that are associated with native. How does metadata impact the form of production?
Well, let me first comment a little bit on what Craig just said in response to my statement about the difficulties of native productions. You know, frankly, we don't disagree on these issues. What he said is accurate. What I said is accurate.
That's true.
In many instances, it just depends on the nature of the litigation at issue, the type of litigation, the parties involved, the data, the volumes. I mean, the scenarios that Craig outlined are acceptable. I mean, I've seen them happen. I've seen them work. And in many instances, when you're producing hundreds of millions of pages, you may not have a choice but to follow the scenarios that I've outlined. So, you know, it really is, and it does come down to the nature of the litigation involved. And that's why I say there is no one solution. And the parties need to be reasonable. They need to talk about it. Get it out up front. Let's be transparent about it. And the more we can do that, the more we can drive down the cost of dealing with these issues. Let's not spend money focusing on things like this. Let's spend the money focusing on the merits of the case. And, you know, I know that I don't get any disagreement about any of that with Craig, but it doesn't always happen the way it should. And I guess that's what I would encourage parties to, is talk about it sooner and be transparent. With respect,
more than disagreement, I'd need clarification about one point you mentioned,
sure.
Which is you said you may, when you're dealing in cases of hundreds of millions of pages, even if we say tens of millions,
yeah,
that the scenarios you outlined with imaging and so forth may be preferable. And the clarification I need is, my sense is, where the volumes are huge, where the numbers of pages or page equivalencies are huge, that's the time when you want to be moving away from image productions and the enormous cost and complexity and loss of information. That's the time you want to be taking the time to work in native and near-native formats. Do you?
And again, you and I won't have disagreement on that, because we'll have clients who will say, you know what, the costs of doing that exceed my concerns or the risks. And you're right, I will provide it in native because I don't want to bear any additional costs. But then we have litigants who say, you know what, it is so essential to me to prevent any of these things from occurring, or I want to work with it in this format, that I'm willing to pay the additional costs. But I want to comment that, you know, a lot of the costs have dropped out, and you know, TIFFing and creating things in PDF is not the it's not the profitable thing that it once was. I mean, these things are now more hassle in many respects. If you'll talk to most vendors, they'll tell you that TIFFing is a pain in the butt, and it's the most, you know, most complex, arduous, time-consuming thing that they do. And so they do, in fact, try to avoid it as much as possible. So, you know, I think that the parties just need to try and work it out. In terms of metadata, look, metadata has wide and varied meanings. We could discuss this all day, and I know we don't want to do that. But, you know, when do I think metadata is impactful for form of production? I think it's important to consider it in terms of the usability of the parties for the format of production. How relevant or how important is it for the litigation? Sometimes metadata is extraordinarily important, and other times not at all. Sometimes particular types of metadata are very important. Sometimes others not at all. What I think is important is to look at, is the metadata necessary for telling the evidentiary story? How relevant is it for purposes of showing to the parties, to the jury, and to in depositions and others, the story? You know, for example, if the case is about when a document is created and copied to another computer as part of a theft of intellectual property, the metadata and document properties and things of that nature may be extremely important, because in this case, you know, the computer itself is an instrumentality of the tort, and knowing as much as you possibly can know about the native file and the file as it exists in its on the computer in the forensic image is essential. In other cases where, you know, it's simply a document request and there's a contractual dispute and one side asks the other side, produce me all the data, you know, metadata may in fact not have very, very much importance here. You know, as long as the data or the ESI is produced in a usable format, allowing them to organize and search, and you know, there's an agreement, a meeting of the minds on the metadata. You know, but finally, and this is an important point, and I know that Craig has some examples here that he wants to discuss. You know, look, there are lots of evolving data types that continue to make this issue more and more complex. There are lots of things going on with things like Facebook and LinkedIn and all sorts of web parts and web pages that add a level of complexity every day to this issue. And in many instances, make metadata for those types of complex, evolving electronic documents to be essential. And so it really depends on the data types.
In essence, I agree with what Tim has said, but there are parts of it that I'm concerned that might be misconstrued by people that are less adept in this area than Tim. And that is the notion that metadata is unimportant for certain kinds of cases is, to me, a fundamental misunderstanding of too many lawyers. You know, the name of a file is its metadata. Most files don't know what they're called. Its location is metadata. The last data was last modified. The time, the settings of the computer time, so you know what time zone you're referred to, so you can organize communication, say, by the time of receipt or the time of sending. These things are all metadata. I don't consider them optional or sometimes important metadata. I consider them essential for the ability to use and make sense of the information. So while Tim emphasized that as long as you agree and as long as you're providing the components necessary to manage it, he and I are in complete agreement. But there is a stream, a species of metadata that for any form of electronic information, you just have to have it. For a file, name, location, path, last modified date and time, offset from UTC on the machine. These things are essential dog tag data. They're as important for a piece of evidence as it would be for a cop pulling somebody over on the road to ask for their license and their insurance card. I mean, you're just going to get certain information because you have to. That doesn't mean the cop is going to take a buccal swab of the inside of a person's cheek or check their footprints or something like that. There are forensic situations. They're the exception, not the rule. So we shouldn't assume metadata is this CSI kind of stuff. It is the same kind of information that we used to use in terms of labels on file folders. We would have been lost without that. It's the equivalent of the dates on documents. Metadata is essential, not every piece of it, but certain parts of it. I wouldn't want a document to be given to me without the embedded commentary and so forth, because that's the same thing to me as if there were handwritten notes on the margin of a printed document. We don't have the right to say, oh, I don't want him to see that. I think I'll just take it out because it's handwriting. We have to give the evidence as it exists unless we have a legitimate basis on which to withhold the evidence, such as privilege.
And, Craig, I'll note that probably every example you raised in my mind is something we would customarily provide as part of a usable format, and those are typically the pieces of metadata that I would agree with you. They are important, and the parties need them for purposes of organizing their data. They need them for purposes of knowing where the particular documents came from. So I don't disagree with you at all on your examples.
And I agree with you, Tim, that when the authenticity of a document is at issue, whether there's a question of forgery or after creation, et cetera, that we may have to go much, much deeper into these very rich veins of metadata. I mean, there are literally hundreds of nested fields of metadata for virtually any file. I mean, you have the metadata for the item, the metadata for the container file, the metadata for the operating system that goes out like I liken it to the Matryoshka nesting Russian doll. So you can go out in the metadata deep, deep, deep.
Where I think we get into the disputes, though, is where parties pound the table and say, let's take my commercial contract dispute and I'm producing hundreds of thousands of pages, and they pound the table and insist that they want all metadata. And, you know, do you really know what you're asking for when you're asking for all metadata? And so, you know, that's where it gets complex and problematic. I think that if the parties are transparent and talk about why they need certain things and why they're helpful to their ability to organize the data and pull them in, generally I think that people are going to cooperate and provide the information that they seek.
If you'll permit a plug, Carl, I just finished a long paper on what I call the Litigator's Guide to Metadata, and it's on my website, craigball.com, C-R-A-I-G-B-A-L-L.com, right now. I think it's only about a week old.
Okay, well, that's a worthwhile and fair plug because, you know, it ties right in. So one of the areas that Craig, you brought up when we were talking about the show was how collection and processing is done can impact how you can produce ESI. So you want to add to that and tell me what your thoughts were?
Well, I think the issue there is you can't go backwards with informational integrity. I mean, once you've dumbed down information, and that may sound like a pejorative way to describe it, but that's essentially it. I mean, information has a complement of data it holds, and as you change it to other forms, you may be adding some new information, but as likely as not, you're losing certain information or functionality. And so it's important to know that if someone is down the line going to need, for example, the system metadata from the source, that if you don't capture that information from the get-go, you may have no means by which to later produce it. So that's why it is so essential for the parties to be on the same page early in the process. And you say, here are the fields we will capture routinely. Here are the things we don't capture. We may capture these, but you're going to have to pay us for the additional cost and effort that it requires. That kind of dialogue shouldn't be adversarial or contentious. It should be early, open, and at worst, a negotiation.
So to wrap out the show here, I'll start with you, Tim, and then Craig. Do you think the industry's figured out production yet? And is that one of the reasons why we haven't done many shows on it, or is there still a lot of work left to be done?
Well, I think what the industry has generally figured out is that there's no single solution, which continues to cause problems. It's a complex area, and I do see that the important trend is that there is earlier and earlier discussion, and I think Sedona and others are promoting some transparency here, and that seems to have taken hold, and I do think that there is less conflicts in these areas so that we can get to the merits of the case, but I don't think that this is an unimportant issue, and I don't think that there is one simple answer. So it's hard to say that the industry has an agreement except to say they're coming up with some rules or standards to follow in certain instances that are guidelines for them as part of coming up with what is a reasonably usable format or when to produce native documents and when not to, things of that nature.
Okay, and Craig, if you have any final thoughts there, or do you agree with Tim?
I think Tim has made a lot of excellent points. I don't think the industry has figured it out from the standpoint of efficiency or lowest cost. In fact, the two drivers, the lawyers and the service providers, have the greatest disincentive to introducing those efficiencies. Lawyers generally are terrified of any process that would require them to do things much differently than they've always done them. And that is one of the great drivers behind conversion of information to much less efficient formats, less utile formats at high cost. The industry has been relatively content, having invested in an infrastructure to do these kinds of conversions to keep doing things in the old ways. The only one who suffers in all of this are the participants in the justice system, the clients, the courts, those who have to foot the bill for these enormously inefficient approaches. So my thinking is, no, it hasn't been figured out. I mean, everybody knows that ultimately we're moving to native formats, that ultimately we'll have to use tools and techniques that deal with them in their true form to save all of this conversion and data loss and all this pain. But nobody really wants to be the first into the swimming pool, okay? It's sort of, it's sort of this frustration that I feel that everyone's pretty fat and happy making money doing things badly, and there's not this impetus to change. But once you get as smart about this as someone like Tim is, you realize very quickly that the most efficient way to work with the information is as close as it exists, and you want to preserve informational parity, that level playing field between what they can see in the evidence and what I can see in the evidence.
Well, it's a good ending there, Craig. I appreciate it. And on that note, Craig and Tim, thanks for joining us on another ESI Bites podcast. It's always a pleasure to have both of you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do many more shows with both of you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibites.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bites of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bites to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurinov, wishing you a nice day.